This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Doctors, what's the scariest thing a patient has ever done? Story one. Not a doctor, but a nurse. Once, a psychotic, schizophrenic patient got to me, and it was because of how normal she said it. She had been screaming, threatening to kill me, and then sat on the commode, and then calmly looked at me and said in the most normal and monotone voice, "I'm sorry. I know I'm not well and being mean to you. I'm in hell, and I don't know how to get out." I will never forget that or how it made me feel. It was like she had a 10-second lapse out of her manic episode just to apologize and tell me how she felt. It made me deeply empathetic toward my psych patients. Story 2. "Doc, I can't wait to have this baby. We'll finally have our baby girl. Now we can stop trying." When I was doing my final year of hospital rotations, I got called into one of the OB ultrasound rooms by the attending. I was just about to leave since my shift had just ended, but I decided to see one last patient since we had such a good shift, and I didn't mind making another patient's day. The attending pointed to the ultrasound and asked if I could see the heartbeat. I thought she was just quizzing me since I was a med student, and I was internally panicking because I couldn't see it. I apologized for what I assumed was my lack of knowledge. Turns out I was called in to confirm the absence of a heartbeat on this 8-month-old baby in utero. They needed two doctors to confirm. I never wanted to be more wrong in my whole life. When I was left alone with the patient, she kept trying to convince herself that she was okay and that she had three other children to come home to. But you could tell how devastated she was. Then she said, "I guess I was right. This was going to be my last baby." And then she just walked out. I was on call the next day and ended up seeing her through pre-op, the delivery, and post-op. She's one of the patients I will never forget. Story 3. I've got one. I'm a psychiatrist with a distinct and relatively rare appearance. Because of this, I've spent my whole life hearing that I look like anyone with a vaguely similar skin tone or hair color, even when I didn't see the resemblance. Fast forward to my intern year. A patient came into the emergency department after being found severely hypothermic, so much so that he was initially pronounced dead. Miraculously, he was resuscitated, but his identity was unknown, and as he began recovering, he started displaying signs of psychosis. That's when the primary team called in a psych consult, and I went to assess him. The moment I stepped into his room, I was taken aback. The man lying in the bed was a spitting image of me, except he looked like an alternate version of myself, one who had gone down a much darker path. His face was weathered, likely from drug use and homelessness, but the resemblance was unsettling. As I tried to gather details about his identity and psychiatric history, he locked eyes with me, his stare intense and unshakable, and said, "I am you." That became his only response whenever he spoke to me. For 3 days, every time I interacted with him, all he would say was, "I am you." Being a sleep-deprived intern, this messed with my head more than I'd like to admit. Seeing someone who looked eerily like me, who had literally been pronounced dead days earlier, repeating that phrase over and over, it freaked me out, to say the least. After a few more days, and as he started coming down from meth-induced psychosis, I finally got through to him. I explained that he couldn't be released as a John Doe and that we needed his identification. Eventually, he gave me his social security number. When we ran it, we discovered he had multiple out-of-state warrants. The whole experience shook me, and I definitely lost some sleep over it. Even now, it still sticks with me. Story 4. Not a doctor or a nurse. One of my uncles had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. He was a tough guy and didn't trust hospitals, so he didn't see a doctor until it was way too late, despite being in debilitating pain. When he finally did, the prognosis was grim. He had maybe 6 weeks left, and pancreatic cancer is a painful way to die. He decided to get MAID instead, medical assistance in dying, which is legal in Canada. On the day we were all gathered around his bed, all the paperwork and permissions were sorted out, and the syringe of drugs was connected to his IV. He was heavily sedated, but he had to be the one to push the plunger, which he did with the help of his wife. He closed his eyes, and his breathing got very shallow and slowed down. After a few minutes, we thought he had passed. We were all standing around him, some saying goodbye, and a lot of people were crying. About 10 minutes passed, and people started to leave when suddenly, in a strong, clear voice, he said, "Russell, wait for me." Then he was gone. Nobody knew who Russell was, and it became a mystery we talked about from time to time. Years later, his wife passed, and when his kids were going through her things, they found a very old photograph of him when he was maybe 5 years old. He was in a sandbox with a small dog. On the back of the picture, in faded ink, it read, "Russell, 1944. The thought that our pets who've gone before us might meet us to help us cross over fills me with comfort. I hope it isn't just a mind trying to make sense of a crazy time. Story 5. When I was a first-year nursing student, I was working in the hospital as a nursing extern, basically a nurse's aide. We had a patient who had some sort of mental disorder. Very odd guy, but he was sweet. I remember a couple of mornings going into his room to do his vitals for his nurse and him telling me, "You're the only one who's nice to me. Everyone doesn't like me here." I knew this was happening, as I would hear the nurses talking badly about this man, sometimes for good reason, but nonetheless, it wasn't nice. Anyway, this patient had an ostomy, look it up if you don't know, and I, as a first-year nursing student, knew absolutely nothing about them. We were literally learning how to wash our hands in school at this point. I did, however, notice that his ostomy pouch was always empty and never collected any waste. I thought this was odd. I would feel his stomach and look, and he was extremely distended. I told his nurse multiple times throughout the week and was always made to feel stupid because they were already checking it. Story 6. Not really a patient who said it. I was on a trauma shift, trauma surgeon, and got called in for a bad car accident. When I got there, they were doing CPR, and eventually we got her back, stable enough for a CT. Another trauma comes in during all this. Turns out to be the husband of the trauma patient. My PA went to go assess the new patient. She came back white as a ghost. Names changed. John just came in next door as the new trauma. I think that's Emily. I looked at our patient who we had just done CPR on and almost fainted. I didn't recognize her until I smelled her perfume. She was so injured, she didn't look like herself. I almost threw up. Emily was another PA on our trauma team. She ended up passing a few days later from a severe brain injury. I think that's Emily will be forever burned into my brain and is among the top 3 reasons I don't do trauma surgery anymore. Story 7. I'm not a doctor, but a nurse. This happened when I was still a CNA. A young woman was brought into the ER for behavioral issues. Her family said she hadn't slept in weeks. She was weirdly quiet for a while, then started biting herself on the wrist. We got violent restraints and she went ballistic, like possession-level screaming. No words, just growling in agony. This went on for a while, and then she calmed back down again. Even weirder, she tested negative for everything except the CT. All of a sudden, the sitter screamed, "She got out!" This lady had ripped off violent restraints, pulling at her skin until it bled. She immediately started slamming her head into the ground. An RN tried to pull her up and got a hard kick to the chest, sending him backward through the door. He was a tall guy. I got scratched, the doctor got punched, and security got bitten. The doctor sedated her with a strong dose of medication. We assumed she'd be out for a while, so we took a breath and started the paperwork for injuries. But not even 5 minutes later, she woke back up and started screaming again. She did this all night. She was too unstable to be transferred to behavioral, so until she was stable, she remained impatient. It was the longest night of my life. I came in the next day. She was still there. She was too violent to go up to a unit, even if there had been space, it was during COVID, and they still had no idea what was actually wrong with her beyond not sleeping, psychosis, and generally wasting away. After a few days of screaming and violence, she just went glass-eyed. We placed a feeding tube, but she kept deteriorating, and after 9 days, she passed away. It took 8 months for our pathologist to figure out what she had. It was a rare prion disorder that can occur in an astronomically small percentage of synthetic opioid users. This was the closest thing I've ever seen to possession. Story 8. I had a patient in my ICU who wasn't unknown to us. She first came to us, then went to a skilled nursing facility, where she'd get sick, come back to my ICU, get better enough to go back to her SNF, and a few months later get sick and come back to us, rinse and repeat. I want to be very clear. It was not at any fault of the SNF skilled nursing facility, your long-term acute care facility. It was her disease process, and it was expected and unavoidable. And one day she was my patient again, and the doctor had already arranged her discharge back to the SNF. She was decently with it, pleasantly confused, but still able to tell me where she was, why.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look great. What have you been doing?
I found Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe the same active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s for 80 to 90% less without insurance. All of mine shipped right to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's care to #250.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
She was there, what year it was, all the basics, but still a little confused. I was chatting with her, and she said, "I'm going home today." I clarified that she wasn't going to her house. She was going back to the SNF, and she waved me off and said, "No, I'm going home. Not back there. I'm going home." Her family came in, and it was the same conversation. They were trying to make her understand that she wasn't going back to her house. And she was like, "Yeah, I'm not going to my house. I'm going home." Strangers walking past her room, she'd wave them down and joyfully tell them she was going home today. "Come say goodbye and give me a hug. I'm going home." And in the middle of me trying to explain again that I wasn't sending her to her house, but to her SNF, and that transport was on the way to take her back there, and that's why I was packing up her things, her eyes just rolled back into her head, and she went asystole. She straight up passed away. I should have known. She was devoutly Christian. And growing up in the church, passing away was often referred to as being called home. I should have caught that nuance. She was serious. She went home. She knew and was trying to tell us, but she wasn't scared. She was happy telling everyone and saying her goodbyes, even to strangers. She was done and made her exit. Story 9. First month as an intern, at this point, I knew everything to crush med tests, but nothing to handle a patient. I was the only doctor covering the night shift at a VA. Code green, which at this location means a patient is hostile. I jog around a corner. I find Mr. S, who I admitted a few hours earlier, now sundowning and holding a piece of broken glass in front of him like a knife. Sundowning is when an elderly, possibly demented patient has increased confusion and/or agitation early in the night, especially in an unfamiliar setting, which every hospital is. He's holding the broken glass toward the charge nurses and screaming nonsense, mainly curse words and saying he wants to go home. Me too, man. Two police officers are standing a couple of yards in front of him. One is touching his sidearm. Nurses and techs are lining the hallway. Lights are on, TVs are on. Mr. S is not enjoying his stay. Everyone looks at me, the youngest, least experienced. Why not? So, what do you do? First thing, I greet Mr. S. I admitted him, so I knew he was a good guy in a confused state. I never mentioned the situation, just started random, polite conversation. Next, I motioned for the officers to leave, the extra nurses and techs to leave, turn off the TVs, turn off the overhead music, and turn off some lights. De-escalate everything. And then with just the charge nurses and me in the hallway, minimal stimulation, we waited him out. Eventually, he forgot about what he was holding as we talked about his wife and fishing outside the city. We did end up giving him a sedative once the danger passed. Not sure if I should have. And the next day, we got him home. Storyten. When I was a CNA working hospice, I got called to assist a nurse who was helping a rather volatile patient. The woman was an alcoholic and chronic smoker who developed lung cancer while also fighting renal and liver failure. She'd had a close call recently while in the hospital and coded very briefly. After that, she became very adamant that no man be let into her room. When I got there, the nurse gave me a heads up that it wasn't just any man she didn't want in her room. It was a particular one, and nobody could figure out who it was. Her son hadn't spoken to her in a decade or more, with the exception of one visit before her close call in the hospital. That was due to her history of sexual, mental, and physical abuse. Her father was long gone. She had no brothers or uncles, and her husband had died tragically a couple of decades earlier. And yet she kept insisting we not let him in. She developed the telltale death rattle, and so we waited. The room went still, and the nurse and I looked at each other, knowing she had just taken her last breath, when suddenly she sat up and started screaming, "He's here! You've let him in! He's here!" Her eyes were wide, her skin pale, and she trembled all over, staring intently at the corner of the ceiling. We tried to assure her no one was there, but she just whispered, "He knows. He's smiling, 'cause he knows," as we got her to lie back down. She closed her eyes and within minutes gave one last rattling breath and was gone. I worked with that nurse again a few months later, and she told me that when she called the son to inform him that his mother had passed, he told her that the last time they spoke, he had told his mother he prayed the devil would come and take her, since she had spent their final conversation trying to use religion to shame him into caring for her in her old age. So, whether the woman was hallucinating her fear or actually saw something sinister coming for her? I don't know, but the nurse seemed to think it really was something evil. She swore she was going to go back to working in a hospital, said she'd seen enough end-of-life care. Story 11. Probably not what you're asking, but the thing I've been most scared to respond to was a 7-year-old girl stopping me while I was talking to her mom. She first asked me if I was a doctor, and I responded yes. Then she asked me very frankly if her dad was going to die. Given that he was intubated on 2 pressors with a multi-drug-resistant infection on top of a hematological malignancy, the real answer was most likely. Striking a balance between remaining honest and not adding extra trauma to her experience, knowing it could possibly be something she carries with her for her entire life without preparation, was terrifying. I was on a consulting team, not the primary team. So I wasn't the one designated to discuss goals of care or overall expectations. So I told her that I didn't know and that her dad was very, very sick and it might take us a long time to know what would happen, but a whole team of doctors and nurses were going to keep trying their best to help him get better. He died several days later. Story 12. I'm a psychiatrist. The scariest patient encounter of my career was during training. I was rotating at the county hospital with the sickest, most acute psychiatry patients. One morning during rounds, a very psychotic patient got extremely agitated, and I watched in horror as he punched open the plexiglass window of the nurse's station. He was going after one of my colleagues. I quickly directed the med students to safety and joined my colleagues and the nurses to contain the situation. This patient brutally beat one of the officers who rushed to our aid and then proceeded to break open the doors to the psych unit. It became an all-hands-on-deck situation, and eventually, we were able to restrain him. I had never seen so much fear in the eyes of the nurses before, and these were seasoned nurses who had dealt with plenty of psychotic patients who had gotten aggressive from time to time. Second most scary encounter, I was on call one night at the same unit. A tall, bulky male patient was requesting to leave AMA after midnight. He was psychotic and unsafe to leave. He said some things that didn't make sense, but I saw that twinkle in his eye, that he was hallucinating while talking to me. I swiftly backed away and escaped into the nurse's station. A second later, I realized I had narrowly escaped being assaulted. He was banging aggressively on the plexiglass, yelling, "You!" Story 13. I was a very new intern, working in the ED. I was asked to see a young woman, and the diagnosis beside her name from the triage staff said self-harm. So I took her into a consult room and tried my best to ask her about what was happening. She said to me, "I think someone was in my room last night." And I thought, that's a strange way to start a conversation about self-harm. But I replied, "Oh, okay. Why do you say that?" And she lifted up her shirt to show me the words, "Help me," carved into her abdomen. The cuts individually were very thin, made by a razor blade. But each letter had been gone over many times, so they were deep and still bleeding. I looked up at her, horrified, and she said, "I don't know who, but someone must have done this to me while I was asleep because I don't remember doing it to myself." The psychiatrist she saw after me thought the patient might have had dissociative amnesia, but I'm not sure what happened after that. That was nearly 20 years ago, and I can still feel the unease of that encounter. Story 14. Not a doctor, but at age 18, I went to Haiti to help with the hurricane crisis that happened, about 6 months after the relief efforts started. We ran a pop-up clinic for people in need of medical care for about 3 weeks. A patient came in. He was the same age as me. He was on crutches and appeared to have a large shard of dry wood stuck in his shin, which looked green and infected. The doctor set to work removing the wood, only to find out that it was exposed bone from a brutal fracture that had occurred 6 to 8 months prior. How he survived, I had no idea. I could only speak limited Creole, but he told me how much pain he had been in and how he just wanted to run and play kickball with his friends again. "I hope you're well, Dante. I still think of you." Story 15. During the first year of my psych residency, I came across this patient, 19-year-old male. He struggled with depression and was admitted to my ward a couple of times. After that, he started coming for regular follow-ups and was doing well. One day, he came to the ward to meet us and gave us sweets and thanked us for everything. It was a very proud moment for me, as he was one of my first patients in the field of psychiatry. That same night, I was on call, and at about 3 a.m., I went up to the main entrance to collect my food parcel. I saw a car heading toward the ER, and someone's legs were sticking out of it. I felt like I recognized those pants, so I walked up to the ER to see who it could be. He had taken his own life that night. Nobody suspected it, not his family, not us. It still haunts me at times. Story 16. I work as an ER nurse. When I was starting off in a rural ER, we had a Hmong woman come in and say she fell. Her ear was missing, and there was a clear human bite mark on her cheek. She refused to tell the actual story. She came in with some friends who seemed equally shocked. I pulled them aside and confronted them. "Who bit this woman?" One of them said, "A cat." And before I could stop myself, I said, "What, like a tiger?" He pretty much went into his shell after that. She did not open up to the police. She was flown to a hospital with a plastics team, and as luck would have it, I knew the nurse who took care of her over there. The plastic surgeons also asked her, and still no answer. I've always thought it was a scorned lover in an insular community, and they covered for them. It really hit me on the drive home at 3 a.m., driving through this tiny town, knowing this person was still out there. Story 17. Not a doctor, but a nurse was nearly beaten to death in a hospital I used to work in. The patient was known to be violent, but no preventative measures were taken. A nurse went into the room to give the patient medications, and the patient jumped on her and repeatedly smashed her head into the floor. One of the other staff members heard a scream and thought he had killed her. There was so much blood everywhere. She ran in and kicked him in the head as hard as she could and dragged the unconscious nurse out of the room. I can't remember what happened afterward, but she survived with permanent damage. Story 18. Nurse here, the amount of abuse we put up with is astonishing, but I'll list a couple of examples. One patient, who had been with us for a few days and was fully alert and oriented, groped one of our nurses. Not an accident, he clearly and intentionally grabbed her and got a good feel. The nurse, understandably upset, escalated the matter to the charge nurse and house supervisor. Police were called, but they didn't bother coming in, probably because they didn't want to make an arrest and have to post a deputy until discharge. When confronted about the incident, the patient stated, "If I see that nurse again, I'll hurt her. I don't care. I'm already on parole." Another patient, under my care, had been admitted from the ER after an apparent intentional overdose. He was restrained when I got him. The story was that he would wax and wane. When he was in the ER, he was practically unresponsive. Then he woke up, immediately stood up, and pinned a nurse to the wall and began strangling her. It took two nurses and a tech to pull him off her, and then five security guards to restrain him back in the bed. We had to renew the order for restraints that night. The doctor asked if I wanted to trial off restraints. Normally I would, patient rights and all. But the sitter was a 20-year-old, 5-foot-tall girl, because it was a psych hold. I politely said, "Not really wanting to try. He strangled a nurse and has a warrant. Don't want to risk a dead sitter." He broke the restraints at least once that night. Another time we had a patient in ICU. The family was obviously stressed. One member in particular was very upset with the care team, not sure why. It got heated with the nurse. When the nurse left the room and came back, there was a loaded pistol on the table next to that family member. Police were called. The family was banned from visiting. Now every visitor gets their bag searched and goes through a metal detector. Story 19. I'm not a doctor, but I'm pretty sure I gave an MD the fright of his life. When I was around 10, a buddy threw a snowball at me and caught me right in the eye. I say snowball, but really it was more like a jagged ice rock gently glazed with snow. I won't go into specifics, but I did need to go to the hospital as the injury was pretty gruesome. Fortunately, it looked worse than it was, and I ended up no worse for the wear. But there was a lot of blood, and the doctors were concerned about damage to the retina. It was also the height of flu season, so as I was being wheeled through the hospital corridors, all I could see when I raised my head were people sitting on the floor with their backs against the walls. It looked like a pre-apocalypse scene from a Stephen King novel. The nurse who was walking me through the hospital told me to keep my eyes closed, and every time I raised my head to look around, he promptly put his hand on my forehead and pushed it back down. I can't stress enough how ingrained it was in me that I had to keep my eyes closed. As the hospital was packed, they had no place to put me, so the nurse put me in a storage room. You know the place they keep routine medical supplies like bandages and tape? Barely bigger than a broom closet. He then told my brother, who was the one who took me to the hospital, that now would be a good time to get coffee. So they both left this 10-year-old kid, who at this point was convinced he would go blind if he opened his eyes, alone in what was essentially a closet. Alone. Oh, and the nurse turned off the light when he left. After a few tense moments of my body seemingly trying to decide if it wanted to pee on the hospital gurney, throw up on it, or worse, some unholy combination of all three, I heard the door open. The light switched on, and there was a brief moment of silence, which I presume was the person quickly noticing a 6-foot gurney in a 6-foot-and-1-inch room. Then I heard this person rummaging through various supply bins around me. Again, I can't stress how ingrained it was that I was not to open my eyes at the risk of total blindness. I literally willed every muscle to stay as still as possible. Then the person in the room dropped something on me, and I flinched. A reasonable reaction, I thought. The person in the room disagreed as he screamed at the top of his lungs and ran out. At no point did I open my eyes. My brother came in a few moments later, laughing hysterically. Turns out the room I was in was also a place they used to temporarily store the bodies of people who didn't survive the ER while waiting for someone from the morgue to retrieve them. The person who came in was a doctor just grabbing supplies and had presumed I was a cadaver. So when I moved, it gave him the shock of his life. Oh, how I laughed and laughed. Years later, I was able to laugh about it. That specific moment when I realized I was in that room, that was when my body decided what it wanted to do on the gurney. I'll spare you the details, but it was almost as traumatic as the eye injury itself. Story 20. Nurse, not a doctor. I work in a pediatric cardiac ICU where things can go bad with little to no warning. Kids can compensate beautifully until they suddenly stop. We had a 3-year-old patient come in with a heart rate in the 200s and 10s, and nothing we did brought it down to an acceptable range. We'd give meds, her heart rate would normalize, then she'd flip back into SVT/tachycardia. She kept drifting off to sleep, then jerking awake suddenly and screaming, clearly terrified, then would fight to stay awake until she nearly passed out from exhaustion. This cycle repeated itself over and over. I had a terrible feeling about her and elevated my concerns to the team, so we weren't totally unprepared for what happened. Close to change of shift, she sat up from a dead sleep, screamed, then collapsed. No pulse, not breathing, crashed to ECMO. Another patient, a 3 or 4 month old, was fussy as soon as I started my shift one morning, intractably crying in and out of atrial tachycardia, which had previously been managed with meds, but otherwise clinically stable. He'd had an IV leak a small amount of irritating fluid into the skin of his arm overnight, so I asked for a dose of pain medication to ensure he wasn't experiencing untreated pain. No change, still screaming. I had 2 patients that day and remember going into the other patient's room early to do meds and assessments and warning the parent at the bedside that I might be getting busy next door. Just a gut feeling. Sure enough, as I finished giving my stable patient his meds, I looked over and saw that my other patient's oxygen saturation had dropped into the 60s. I went over, put oxygen on him, called a provider, and when I listened with my stethoscope, I realized he'd lost blood flow to his lungs. Nearly crashed to ECMO, we managed to intubate him emergently and get him to the cath lab, where they stented the structures to get blood to his lungs. He discharged from the hospital a week later with no residual effects. Story 21. On my psych rotation as a third-year student, I was sent to interview a man who had come into the ER. He was a young, very muscular male, physically imposing. I couldn't get him to talk, but suddenly he walked over to me in the small room we were in and took the pens out of my coat pocket. As images of being stabbed in the neck, like in that scene from Casino, flashed through my mind, he just went and sat back down. I calmly but rather quickly exited and went on with other tasks. Maybe an hour later, I watched 4 police officers pinning him to the ground and putting him in restraints. I saw him on the ward a few days later, and he actually apologized. I wish I could remember what his diagnosis was. Story 22. Not a medical professional, but I remember a conversation I had with my grandmother when one of her sisters had passed. Grandma said she was on the phone with her, and my great aunt started talking like their late father was there in the room with her. That's when Grandma knew it wouldn't be long. My great aunt passed a few days later. Then Grandma looked me directly in the eye and told me, "That's how you'll know when it's my time. If I ever start talking to your grandfather or your late Aunt Margaret, you'll know I'm about to pass." 20 years later, I had moved out of town and was talking to my mother. Grandma had gotten to the point where she needed to stay with someone and was living with one of my mother's sisters. Mom called me to tell me that Grandma had been admitted to a nursing home that night as she was starting to hallucinate. She was having a full-on conversation with not only her late husband, but several other relatives who had passed. I felt a chill and said, "Mom, it's her time. She won't make it through the night." Time of death. The exact moment I felt that chill. Story 23. Not a doctor, but a CNA. I have 2 instances that totally freaked me out. The nursing facility I worked at had been a farm back in the day, and people had lived on the property since at least the early 1900s. It was town lore that a young man was run over and killed by a tractor. One time I was doing care on a lady, and I was facing her. She was dying from pressure, sores, and cancer, but was still pretty lucid. She goes, "I bet you're stronger than him." Wanting to brag to the male nurses, I asked her, "Who?" She goes, "That boy." There were like 3 young male nurses, so I asked, "What boy?" Because she still knew all of us by name, And like I said, I wanted to brag. She goes, "That boy sitting in the chair behind you." There was no one else in the room. I never left a room so fast in my life. Still get chills retelling it. A lot of times before people would pass, they would mention seeing a boy and a black dog. One time, a call light flicked on, and the nurse and I went into another lady's room. She was 100% lucid, totally fine, and barely needed assistance. We often sat and chatted with her. She goes, "Hey, girls, where did that big black dog go?" We said, "Wait, what black dog?" She said, "Well, the black dog that was just laying in my bed. His owner brought him in, and then he ran out." Obviously, this freaked us out because usually only the residents about to pass talk like this. And this lady was totally fine. We ended up leaving. A few hours later, she fell and completely hit her head on her metal table. Totally unexpected. She passed away as soon as she got in the ambulance. Story 24. I'm not a doctor, but my partner is. Naturally, she always shares her best war stories with me. This is one that stands out as particularly freaky, shocking, and unsettling. She works in the emergency department. A female patient presented with an open wound on her left arm. The cause of the injury wasn't clear. It had rough edges and likely wasn't caused by a blade. It was too fresh to be from xylazine. My partner was closely inspecting it and trying to gather information from the patient. Suddenly, the patient screamed, looked down at her right arm, and bit into her own bicep. She proceeded to rip a golf ball-sized chunk of flesh out of her arm before staring directly into my partner's eyes, with skin in her mouth and blood dripping down her chin. Sounded to me like a scene straight out of a horror movie. In keeping with that theme, she also had a different patient present with leg pain from a pretty bad xylazine wound. What the patient was seemingly unconcerned about was the fact that his arm from the elbow down had fallen off several months prior. All that remained of his right arm was the humerus, which was completely exposed. No skin, no muscle, no tendons, no blood, just exposed bone from the shoulder to the elbow. I can't imagine seeing that guy walking down the street. Story 25. Before I, NP, worked in the ER as a tech RN NP begin, I'll preface with what I tell everyone outside of healthcare who asks something like this. You realize that you're asking me to flip through a filing cabinet of nightmares and select the ones that stand out the most, right? A bloody woman was brought in by EMS, wrapped in a blanket. She had been found lying on the side of the road. They left her wrapped because she wailed every time they tried to unwrap her and figured it would be faster to just get her to us rather than wrestle her out there. She was clearly bludgeoned. It was hard to tell the difference between her bloody clothes and the blanket. After getting vitals and trying to build rapport, she was still partially covered and just said, "Him," while glancing to her side. I slowly pulled the blanket back to find a bloody child. I don't remember what happened next. I think I suppressed that memory. Then there was the eerie, smiling glare of a large psychiatric patient who was incredibly calm while I got him settled. After a few moments, he made a threat I barely heard, started to move, then was restrained by a few officers while I sedated him. I found out afterward that he was with me because they had found him lying with his mother, but her head was in another room, with his machete. Last one that comes to mind was an overdose patient who was supposedly very sick and hooked up to everything. I was doing my assessment on the sleeping patient while alone in my trauma room. Another nurse was on the other side of the curtain. I was assessing the patient in peace when they opened their eyes, said sorry, and started to strangle me with the wires. The other nurse heard the quiet fuss and ran over to save me. She was an older nurse, but the way she could hogtie a violent patient with the sheets convinced me she was ex-CIA. Those are the three I can't really pick between for this question. Story 26. Not a doctor, but still terrifying. About 100 years ago, I was 19 and an RNA at a long-term care facility. I had a resident who had been there for years and years when I started. She was stiffened into the shape of sitting in her wheelchair, solid. Her limbs did not move other than a sort of flailing she could do with her arms, which allowed her to repeat a behavior while screaming, "I need a man," at the top of her lungs. And most of the time, she was incoherent, apparently unaware of the goings-on around her. One day, she seemed to snap out of it long enough to look me in the eye and say, "I used to be like you. I used to be normal." And then, as quick as that, she was gone again. I was stunned. She had never actually communicated before. It freaked me right out. How aware was she? Had she been aware this whole time? I've thought about her many times over the years. Talk about don't take your health for granted. She was old then and has surely passed by now, so I can say her name. I remember you, Norma. I hope you found peace. Story 27. As a medical student during a psychiatric rotation, one of the patients used a chair and hit a fellow medical student on the back of her head. We were all rounding as a group, 5 to 6 students, standing at the back of the team and facing another patient's bed, so we didn't see it coming. It was completely random and not targeted at any of us in particular. The student was ushered out and wasn't outwardly injured. The patient wasn't strong or in a particularly psychotic rage, so it wasn't a big hit. We all thought nothing more of it and went our separate ways. Just another tale for drinks at the end of the rotation. That student who was accidentally hit suffered from a Curie malformation and had elective aneurysmal repair about 6 months prior. About a week after the incident, I got a call from our hospital supervisor asking if we had heard from her, as she hadn't attended placement for a few days, and it was not like her. Police were called to do a welfare check, and she was found to have passed away in her sleep. I always think about whether things would have been different if the patient had hit one of the other students instead, or if we had just been paying more attention. Story 28. Not a doctor, but a CNA, working on a floor with a lot of private hospital rooms. We often had dementia patients or patients with significant behavioral issues who couldn't be roomed with someone else. This patient had dementia and was still pretty young and independent. So the floor provided her with a one-to-one sitter to make sure she didn't elope while in hospital care. I walked in to give the sitter her break during a night shift. I'd had this patient 2 nights before, but she had always been sleeping the whole time I sat with her for the break. On my 3rd night, she was awake. At first, the things she was saying and doing were kind of normal for dementia patients I'd seen before. Taking off her clothes, asking where her belongings were, trying to remove her ID bracelet, etc. But as the break continued, her words started getting more and more concerning. She typically repeated phrases in pairs or threes, saying things like, "It's so pretty in here. So pretty. It's so pretty in here," in a kind of dreamy sing-song voice that was a little off-putting, but still manageable. Then, as it continued, her words got more morbid. She started saying, "They're all gonna burn, Mama. All those pretty little houses, Mama. They're all gonna burn, Mama." This progressed to, "We're all gonna burn to death, Mama. We're all dying, Mama. I'm evil, Mama." I've never run out of a room so fast once the sitter came back. Story 29. Scariest thing a patient has done? I had a notoriously violent inmate slip out of his cuffs in the ED room and start attacking the correctional officer with him. I'm a pretty big guy, so I went running in to help. It was just me and the officer trying to get this man under control for what felt like an hour. Punches, kicks, choking. It turned into a full-blown struggle, with the man even trying to grab the officer's weapon. I honestly thought one of us was going to die or get seriously injured. I tried to press charges and went to court, only to be told by the judge that this was accepted as part of my job. That was my first foray into the reality of bail reform in New York State and into the realization that nobody in the criminal justice system really has our backs. It really changed my view of the county and the state. It was the only time I've ever had to defend myself physically against a patient. And although it was justified, it still left a mark. Sketchiest moment? A third-year resident I worked with went to see a patient who came in with a complaint involving a private area. The man exposed himself and, unbelievably, managed to do something extremely inappropriate, right on the resident's hand. How he had such control, I will never understand. Then, as if that wasn't enough, he threw a full bedside container at the nurse and ran. We tried to press charges again because it was clearly a serious incident, but were told no, since he was labeled a psych patient. Unfortunately, many of us in healthcare have stories like this. Story 30. My first patient on the internal medicine service as an intern came in from a nursing home where she'd been having horrible diarrhea and confusion. I went to assess her and asked the most basic question about what had happened that morning. At the time, it didn't seem like such a terrible thing for her to say, but she looked at me and simply said, "I don't feel good." I tried asking more questions, but she didn't say anything else intelligible. Shortly after that, she slipped into a semi-conscious state and never woke up again. She passed away before her family could make it to the hospital. Those were her last words, and I'm the only one who heard them. It bothers me to think about, mostly because I had no idea she would go downhill so quickly. I wish I had said more, or done more, to be comforting in that moment. Story 31. Not a doctor, but a respiratory therapist. I was working the med-surg floor when I got called to a rapid response for a patient. He had torn his abdominal aortic aneurysm repair. Not sure of the exact medical term, but this man was actively bleeding out. It was just me and three nurses trying to hold pressure with gauze while he bled heavily from his abdominal cavity. His wife had just stepped out to the cafeteria to grab something to eat, so security quickly went to find her and bring her upstairs. The whole time, the patient was still talking to us, even though he was losing so much blood. When his wife arrived, we were still waiting on the surgeon, and the patient told her that she needed to call his brother and to let him know that he loved him. The way he said it hit me deeply. He knew he wasn't going to make it, even though his wife remained hopeful and said she would call his brother. The surgeon finally arrived, and they wheeled the patient to the OR. They called for blood transfusions nearly 14 times. I was later sent down to the CICU to help with another patient when I saw the man being wheeled in on a stretcher. He had passed away in the OR, and they had brought him back to CICU so his family could say goodbye. It was one of those moments where you just couldn't help but cry for him and his family. The fact that he knew it was the end and that we had tried everything still stays with me. Story 32. When I was a third-year med student on my psych rotation, our attending told me to go evaluate a man in the ER. When I got there, he was furiously scribbling on a piece of paper with some crayons that one of the ER nurses had given him. As I progressed through my questions for the evaluation, he occasionally looked up, but didn't seem to pay too much attention to me. He seemed to be thoroughly focused on his drawing. I finally finished up and was ready to go back and present the patient to my psych attending. The patient then asked me, "Do you want to see my drawing?" I thought, "Sure, I'll try and build a little rapport with this poor guy." So he shows me a full-page drawing of me nailed to a cross, with Dr. X, my name, "Will Die for My Sins" written above it. I didn't stop to clarify that I was only a med student and not a doctor yet, because I immediately left the room and headed straight back to where I came from. It turned out to be a great story later, but it was absolutely terrifying at the time. Story 33. I'm a nurse. The scariest thing that ever happened to me was when we had a patient brought in from a house fire. She had severe smoke inhalation, so she needed to be intubated right away. Her husband rushed to the hospital and dotingly waited on her hand and foot the entire time she was intubated. We told him when her extubation date would be and asked him to be there. When the day came, we were actually quite surprised that he didn't show. When the patient woke up, she said, with the scariest look in her eyes, I've never been married. What did he look like?" As we described him, it came to light that he was actually her high school sweetheart and stalker. He never showed his face again, and we all believed he was involved in setting the fire. The investigation later confirmed it was arson. And before anyone asks how this could happen, I'd like to clarify that this woman had no family, no friends, and no emergency contacts. It's not like we're checking marriage certificates. She was so frightened, you guys. What hurts the most is knowing she passed away from an infection in her burns and skin grafts. She was in her 20s, and I'll never forget the fear in her face. Story 34. I was on night call and went to check in on a patient admitted with autoimmune encephalitis. It was around 2 a.m., and the room was mostly dark. There was just a soft light illuminating the bed. When I walked in, I saw her sitting on the edge of the bed facing the wall, having a conversation. It wasn't some irrelevant speech of delirium. She was actually holding a conversation. She spoke softly, then paused like she was listening. She was really calm. I couldn't make out what she was saying. When she heard me, she just paused, slowly turned to look at me and smiled. Creepiest smile ever. I just did a U-turn and left. I went back in with the nurse not even 2 minutes later, and she was lying down fast asleep. That was really strange. It wasn't unexpected, to be honest. Similar behavior had been noted in her medical history. But yeah, it creeped me out. Turns out the family had initially thought she was possessed and even brought her to a priest for an exorcism. Story 35. 2 days ago, during my night shift, the alarm on the monitor of a patient who was already in the palliative stage suddenly rang at 2 a.m. It showed an O2 saturation of 85%. so I went to check on her. She was comfortably sleeping, but without her oxygen nasal cannula. I tried to put it back, but accidentally woke her up. She said she didn't want to wear it because she felt okay. She said she didn't need it. While I was explaining to her that the monitor showed her body wasn't getting enough oxygen and that it was better if she wore it, the O2 kept desaturating. I think at one point she realized she truly couldn't get enough air, and she started to panic. I put the nasal cannula back on her and turned up the oxygen volume. The saturation didn't improve, even after about 10 minutes, and she still felt like she couldn't get enough air. At one point, she took my hand and said she wasn't afraid, over and over again. Story 36. Not a doctor, but I encountered a woman who had experienced a complete mental breakdown. I was working reception at a housing association, and this woman came in asking if we could give her a house. She had no documentation, and I explained that she would need an ID, a letter with her current address, etc. She said she couldn't provide those because she lived in London. We were in Liverpool, about 140 miles away. She explained that she wanted to move to Liverpool because she liked Brookside and couldn't deal with looking after her sick mother anymore. I can't recall if it was dementia or cancer, but she was basically her full-time carer. We told her there was nothing we could do and begged her to go back home and seek mental health treatment. We managed to convince her to book the next bus back to London, but it was departing within the hour, so she needed to leave right away. We watched her go across the road to a McDonald's, talking to people and milling about. She missed the bus. I still think about that poor, poor woman. I hope she got the help she needed. Story 37. Not a doctor, but a patient. I had really bad tonsillitis, and things quickly became abnormal. I was extremely weak and felt myself slipping. I arrived at emergency and told the nurse that something wasn't right. She took my blood pressure and immediately brought me to a bed. An emergency doctor came and I said, "I'm dying." I didn't even think it. It just came out. The next minute, I was surrounded by multiple ICU doctors, nurses, and emergency staff, all telling me there was no way it was my time. It turns out I had strep A sepsis from tonsillitis combined with an adrenal crisis. I have known Addison's disease. I woke up in ICU on one-to-one care. I don't know how I knew it, but I truly believe I was dying. I'm so glad I was believed, and I truly think that them listening to me is the reason I'm still here today. The doctor from the ER came to see me afterward. He said he knew I was very unwell, but hearing the words, "I'm dying," made him take it even more seriously. He said he always believes patients when they say that. Story 38. Out of the line of question, but this is a story from the ER. As a student, we were supposed to attend the ER once a week just to observe and help residents here and there. It was my first ever visit to the ER. As we entered the room, it was full of chaos. It might have been normal chaos for them, but I couldn't understand how they all could make sound decisions in that atmosphere, or how they could even communicate. It was like a fish market. It was the complete opposite of the typical hospital setup we see on TV series. Silence had long since left the room. My friend pointed out a corner where a body was lying. Lifeless. He must have been about 19. Male. The whole bed and floor were painted red, of course, with blood. His head was split open. The surprising part was that no one even looked at him. No one seemed to care. The whole area was unaffected by the presence of a dead body. It must have been that common to them. They were all busy with their work. I was taken aback. At that very moment, a woman around 40 entered the room, crying uncontrollably and screaming to the heavens. She held her son's head in her lap and cried her heart out. I couldn't stand it. I told my friend I needed to leave. I wasn't able to witness that. Every other person was unflinched. To the hospital, to the doctors, he might have just been another patient with a road traffic accident. Just another number on a list. We might never even know his name. But there is always a story behind every life and death. One that can change every dynamic in a family, maybe even for future generations. I still try to be a good person before being a good doctor. Story 39. Definitely not a doctor, but a patient. 4 days after my botched hysterectomy, as I lay in bed begging for help, the nurses ignored me. I finally grabbed one of their arms and said, "I'm going to die here." And she called me a drama queen and left the room. They found out I was septic not even 20 minutes later, and I ended up coding after 3 surgeries trying to fix the damage. I did get a chance to talk to that nurse once I recovered, and I told her how hopeless she made me feel. I told her she made me doubt myself. She made me feel like I was exaggerating my symptoms, when in fact I was slipping into septic shock because they ignored me. That moment, her calling me a drama queen, was a pivotal moment in my life that I will never forget. It shows how unbelievably important it is that medical professionals look at the whole picture and don't make assumptions about what they think is going on. 5.5 weeks after my botched hysterectomy, I coded in the ICU and was gone for about 30 seconds. They told my family I wouldn't make it through the night, all because the nurses thought I was being dramatic. Story 40. Not a doctor, but my niece scared a team of medical professionals. She was pregnant and being induced 3 weeks early due to preeclampsia starting to get out of control, as well as an otherwise high-risk pregnancy. She had planned not to get an epidural, but about 24 hours in, the doctor recommended it, I think to help manage her blood pressure. The anesthesiologist came in and started the epidural. After a moment, she said, "I feel like I'm going numb from the shoulders down." He told her it was a fairly normal sensation. A minute later, she said, "I'm going to tip over." You have to sit on the edge of the bed during the procedure. Her doctor and her boyfriend managed to catch her and lie her back. Then she said, "I can't breathe." That's when the doctor realized something was seriously wrong. She looked him in the eye and said, "Tell my baby I love her," with a fading voice, and then she stopped breathing. She had an extremely rare epidural complication that completely paralyzed her from the shoulders down. She was fully conscious but completely unable to move or breathe on her own. The anesthesiologist had to manually bag her, using a pump connected to a mask to breathe for her, while rushing her into the C-section suite to get her on a ventilator and under general anesthesia. She remained on a ventilator for several hours while the paralysis wore off, and both she and the baby spent time in the ICU. But they're both home, happy, and healthy now. Miraculously, my niece says she wasn't that frightened herself. She described it as the detached serenity a lot of people report during near-death experiences. The anesthesiologist later told her he nearly panicked when she said, "Tell my baby I love her." I don't blame him. Apparently, she experienced a combination of 2 or 3 extremely rare complications, things the doctor had never seen before and wasn't prepared to treat. Still, he did an amazing job, as did her OB, who delivered the baby with an impressively small and neat scar despite the intense time crunch of an emergency C-section. From what I understand, they only have minutes to get the baby out before the anesthesia affects the baby too. Story 41. I'm a nurse. I had a patient admitted for severe withdrawal. He was in a double room, but with no roommate, so essentially alone. He was about 6 feet 5 inches tall, I'm 5 feet 0 inches tall, and was about 8 months pregnant at the time. His bed alarm went off in the early morning, and I saw the bathroom door open. I silenced the alarm and peeked into the bathroom, but he wasn't at the toilet. I turned on the light and went into the room, and he closed the door behind me. He had been hiding behind the open door. He got right into my personal space and said, "You've got a pretty mouth." He said it very quietly, which made it even worse. The whole thing was beyond uncomfortable, so I just said the first thing I thought of, which was, "No." We looked at each other for a second, and then he nodded and just opened the door. I called someone to come help me put him back to bed. There was an emergency alarm in the bathroom with us, but I take the time now, when responding to patient alarms, to do a better safety check for myself, even if it delays care by 30 seconds. Story 42. Not a doctor or nurse, but a patient who has worked several jobs in the medical field. I remember going to my gynecologist and just word vomiting about my past doctors. I went into a panic attack and remember saying, I'm so sorry, but nobody believes me ever, and I guess that's just how it goes. He scooted his chair closer to comfort me, and I full-on flinched. I felt like a plot straight out of Grey's Anatomy. He went back to his desk area and looked like he wanted to break the desk in half. He was so angry on my behalf. I kept telling him it was okay, and he said, "Hey, look at me. None of what was done to you was okay. I need you to understand that." I cried for days after that appointment. I actually opened up to my therapist of 10 years about all the sexual trauma and abuse. It was like starting over from the beginning. I knew I had pushed a lot down about certain topics, but seeing this super calm and kind doctor ready to break a table because he cared about what happened to me, That changed everything. I made a doctor upset. Because he cares, it really changed my life. Story 43. My mom had been in the hospital for a couple of days and returned to the nursing home, so I stayed with her that first night back. She slept in a recliner, and I lay on the bed, dozing in and out, but mostly watching and listening to her. I heard her saying, "Oh God," and smiling and laughing, not as an exclamation, but like she was having a conversation with God. Then she said, "The streets really are made out of gold." She went back to the hospital the next day and stayed in a regular room for half the day. She was very coherent, visiting with family that came in. She even told us to remember that the nursing home owed her money. She was right. They did. They moved her into the hospice part of the hospital that afternoon. We had one family member who was late getting there. But after he arrived, she was resting while we were all in there, talking about this and that. I was watching her, and there was just a piece about her. She had passed on while listening to us all visit with each other. It happened so quickly that the hospice staff hadn't even had a chance to do any paperwork. Story 44. I was a medical student doing a pediatric cardiology rotation. One of the patients, a 10-year-old girl, had a congenital heart disease. With medical management, her life expectancy was around 6 to 8 years. She looked good clinically, but her imaging and ultrasound looked horrible. She was laughing and joking. She had been a patient there since birth and knew everyone. One of the assistants took her out of the room to play so we could talk privately with the family. The cardiologist reviewed the imaging with her parents and explained that things were looking bad. Her life expectancy at this point was less than a year, maybe 6 months. I could hear how shaky the cardiologist's voice was. Everyone was barely holding back tears. The parents were crying, yet still thankful. The girl walked back in, laughing and saying, "When I grow up, I'm going to be a doctor just like you." I smiled at her, but the mood in the clinic was completely off and somber all day. I cried all night and prayed for her. That was the day I realized I couldn't go into any specialty that involves kids. It's still hard, but it's easier for me to treat sick adults or the elderly. I still think about her. Story 45. Veterinarian here, I had an older Chihuahua come in for a routine dental cleaning. Chihuahuas can live a surprisingly long time, but this girl was around 7 to 8 years old, so senior but not geriatric. Her owners were nervous and said they had a bad feeling about the day. My technicians did the intake and reassured the owners. "We do this all the time. Her pre-op labs were fine, etc." We got her under anesthesia, and we were about 3/4 of the way done when my assistant called me over to check the monitor. Pretty much as soon as I recognized the heart rhythm, basically the electrical signals weren't traveling all the way across her heart like they should, her heart stopped entirely. We performed CPR but never got her back. I absolutely give more credence to owners' gut feelings after that day. I'm more patient with people who are nervous about putting their pets under anesthesia. I still recommend things like dental cleanings and spay-neuter, but I'm honest that every procedure carries risks, including death.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.